Good afternoon. This is panel number 3309, Pussy Grabs Back, Women on the March. We're scheduled to run from 3 o'clock to 4:20. My name is Sherry Rose Anderson. I was asked to moderate this panel because I was one of millions who marched on the first Women's March. Yay! and I think, for a lot of people, this was a new awakening. We didn't think we needed to be in the streets, but we found out we needed to be in the streets. And so I'm happy, I'm really looking forward to exploring these topics, the idea of how women are going to be involved, how we can be inclusive mm-hmm. in involving women with these wonderful women sitting next to me. So we've got Heather Hurlburt, who's the director of New Models of Policy, New America. And she's next week, she has managed to arrange for a private meeting at Congress to talk about the culture of sexual harassment in government. We have Erin Velarde, founder of Run, Vote, Lead. They have recently put together an official declaration of power to end a culture of harassment and assault that they are encouraging the women who sign up with them to sign on to. I look forward to hearing more about it. And finally, Jessica Rogers. She's the co-founder of the March on Colorado and has been involved with the Women's March Colorado. She's been working with Me Too, the Me Too movement, to make the Women's March, to make those Me Too and the Women's March help them work together with the Raise Your Hand movement that was used in the marches on Sydney, Rome, and London, among others. So, Heather, would you like to get started?
Thank you. And I want to thank you a little extra because, boy, this is not a topic I ever expected to be sitting on a stage talking about. I did not start my career with the idea. In fact, I started my career explicitly with the idea that I was not going to work on women's issues. I was just going to be, damn it, the best there was in my field. And if that meant having to be twice as good as a man, that was okay. I could do that pretty easily, I thought. Still think that?
Still do.
No disrespect. Not all men. I know some smart guys. But what I loved about this panel was the challenge it posed to me to say, okay, what's next? Which I think is a question we're all asking and that we're all going to explore together. So I've been asking everyone that I've talked to in the last few hours, okay, what should I say on this panel? And I was talking to Bonnie, who's one of the speakers with an entertainment industry background at lunch, and she said, oh, you should talk about the next season of Jessica Jones. And I was like, that would require me to pretend that I know enough about pop culture to know what Jessica Jones is, which is a pretty big fail. But her point was, this is the superhero who's the anti-superhero who won't wear a costume and who deals with men by just punching them out. And drinking. Thank
yeah,
you.
It's
see,
it's a good joke.
I appreciate the help now that I've confessed my total pop culture ignorance. But I think we're all at a moment where, I mean, we're all in a place, at least those of us who are maybe over 30, never expected to be, where I could sit on a panel and casually reference that I had a boss who grabbed my ass. And that I had a boss who said to me, oh, I had to hold your job open for a woman, and I hired you and I dated the other one. And let me tell you, I way got the better end of that deal. and it's still, I mean, just look at your reaction. It's shocking and it's amazing and it's liberating and it's really weird that we can get up here and say these things. But, you know, the guy that I had to fire for sexual harassment is running for public office this cycle. And the gentleman who said, you know, I hired you and dated the other one is still out there pulling down a very nice six-figure income. And, you know, do I want those people? What is it that I want? And that's just me personally. And there are millions and millions of women who are never going to, number one, they're never going to have a microphone. And number two, nobody's going to think their story is interesting. So at once, the work of telling the stories is incomplete, and the work of figuring out and then what is really barely starting. And so the idea of Jessica Jones drinking and punching guys, or punching anybody, because there are some women I'd like to punch too. I'm equal opportunity when it comes to punching. But we're just at the beginning of this process, and so I really think we're all about figuring this out together. So I'll tell a couple stories from my sector, the national security sector, and one is the one that Cherry alluded to in her introduction, which is that a member of Congress is holding a small group conversation to try to figure out what do we do about a culture of sexism at the State Department. And my first response was, oh, I worked at the State Department 20 years ago and nothing bad happened to me because I didn't get raped. And I was like, I don't want to take up space and I want women that something really terrible happened to be able to tell their stories. And then I kind of thought, wait, I think in 2018, I'm supposed to get beyond that habit of thinking. So I wrote to the organizer and I said, here's my deal. This was 20 years ago. And I was a political appointee. I wasn't in the regular bureaucracy. Is this useful or not? And she wrote back and said, actually, we desperately need older women to kind of ground the conversation and be reassuring to some of the younger women. So, yeah, I really would like. And so, you know, I was like, oh, okay, now I have to get used to being in that phase of my life where my job is that. But all right, we got to roll with it. So, and again, that's not a place I ever thought I would be, and I don't know what that congresswoman is going to do with the information. I don't know what, frankly, I don't know what the possibilities are. I'm not sure I have answers to how to fix the culture of sexism at the State Department or anyplace else, but that, you know, sort of being willing not just to sort of either tell my story or choose not to tell my story, but then to say, okay, how can I choose to be part of the solution? And then once I start thinking about it, I have a million choices a day, and I'm a very privileged person to have as many choices as I do every day about how to be part of the solution. And so I'll tell you one thing I'm proud of and one thing that I'm less proud of. You may know there is a horrendous, horrendous problem of sexual abuse in our military. And by the way, not just of women. The actual raw number of sexual assaults on men is higher than it is on women. So we have a huge problem with a culture of sexualized violence, which maybe part of addressing it is going to be when we understand that it is a woman's problem and it's a broader problem. So the Marines in particular have had these repeated scandals of setting up private chat groups where they assess the hotness of their female colleagues and trade nude pictures, which may have been obtained under consensual or non-consensual circumstances, but certainly no one said, oh yeah, you can show this to a chat group of thousands of guys. And those get shut down, and then a few months or years later, they pop right back up again. Mm. And so it's clear that, you know, someone's at least thinking about accountability, but nobody's figuring out how to change the culture in any real way. So women at the Pentagon called a stand down. And in the military, a stand down is what you do when you realize you've got a problem so grave it impairs the safety of your soldiers. And so you stop your operations, you stop whatever you're doing, and all you do is fix the problem. So they called a stand down outside the Pentagon at 7 o'clock on a cold morning. And a few of us civilians showed up to support them. Basically, me and a woman who had been one of the most senior career ambassadors at the State Department and the most senior African-American woman until she was pushed out by the Trump administration. And what did she choose to do at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday morning but go out and support these military women, which was very inspiring to me. And we're standing there and we're holding up signs and people are walking by. And women started walking out of the Pentagon to join us. And again, that's not an answer, it's not a solution, but it's starting to change the culture where those women felt that it was safe for them and it was important for them to come be on the outside. So now the thing, I'll conclude with the thing that I'm not so proud of, which is I sat on this very, very panel 2 days ago having a wonderful conversation about intervention. Was anybody in the room for that one? You guys, it's the most amazing thing to have fans, by the way, to be just sort of an ordinary person who has... did any of you notice, any of the people who raised your hands, any of you guys notice anything about the language in that panel? So I counted, in the first 20 minutes, I counted three instances of just incredibly sexualized language of how we talk about U.S. relations with other countries. And some of them were things that, you know, frankly, we're so used to, oh, ha, ha, you know, Donald Trump has a little stick, ha, ha. And you don't, like, that doesn't even, that's so inherent in our culture that it doesn't even register with you anymore. And then one of the gentlemen, who's a very nice guy who I have a very good relationship with, said, oh, well, you know, in a certain kind of intervention, we really get into the knickers of the other countries. And I flinched, and I thought, okay, Heather, it's 2018, you should call that out. And I couldn't figure out how. And I'm still mad at myself, and that's why I'm telling you about it. Because, you know, and I don't want to punch the guy. I mean, there are some guys, but I don't, and it wouldn't help me to punch this guy. But if I haven't even figured out how to sit on a panel with another nice, rational person and turn to him and say, do not talk about my body that way. If I haven't figured that out, how the hell are we going to fix anything in the long term? So that's where we are from my perspective.
Thank you, Heather. There's lots I want to follow up with you on that. But let's move now to Erin Velarde, please.
Sure. Hi, I'm Erin Velarde. I'm the founder of Vote Run Lead. We train women to run for office and win. We specialize in local and state office, which is awesome, where there are 519,000 seats. There are 535 in Congress, so start giving your money locally. Lots more women need it. And I can offer one solution in that if we want to create different policies, if we want to see a better culture of valuing women, our contributions, and our bodies, we have to be in charge. We have to be in public office. We have to be not just CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, but we have to be bosses of our divisions. We have to be holding men accountable. We have to create environments where younger women can feel comfortable fighting for titles of panel like this. And I want to share that I think there's so much to say about this topic. Now, after hearing what Heather has shared, you know, I was just jotting down a handful of the industries where we're seeing some of a culture of sexual assault and harassment become recognized. And it's the armed services, it's tech, it's government, it's restaurants, it's car manufacturers, it's in television news, it's in progressive circles, it's at NPR, it's in the presidency, Hollywood, comedy, it's in the ballet, it's on public radio. And I just stopped after that. I was like, this is making me sad, right? It's everywhere. This is a moment actually to stand down. This is a moment to say, if we are valuing women's leadership, if we are valuing the contributions of women, then we have a huge problem. And I think why young women fought for this panel at CWA is because our younger women, our daughters, our nieces, have said to us, hey, you guys went out there. You broke those original glass ceilings. You're the first this, you're the first that. In many instances, we're seeing the first women of color, the second woman sit in these positions. And I still have to go to work and potentially be touched by one of my colleagues or a boss. And I'm still opting out of industries. The talent pool that we are potentially losing and have lost in this country over the last however many years by women choosing to get out of armed services, tech, government, restaurants, car manufacturers, television, progressive causes, the presidency, Hollywood, comedy, ballet. The talent that we have lost by women stepping outside of these careers because the environments and the workplaces that we are in have not been a safe place for them to be both physically and emotionally. And this is a moment to stand down. This is a moment to have these kind of conversations. One solution that Vote Run Lead is offering is we have begun to build in how to talk about sexual harassment and assault on the campaign trail, how to weed it out of your own personal campaign, how to hold men that you care about and who you love accountable. these are our brothers, these are our sons, these are our colleagues, and it's okay to be flawed, right? To have these conversations and to say, actually, that's probably not the best way to go about talking to your female candidate if you're the campaign manager, right? That's not the best way to get the most out of your team by creating environments that use words like knickers, and that's a light one, right? And so it's difficult. It's uncomfortable. I even feel uncomfortable right now. My body feels uncomfortable. I have this, like, heat radiating off of me. My face is probably getting redder by the moment. And this is the kind of way we have to be talking about this very uncomfortable subject if we want to actually see change. So at Vote Run Lead, one of the things that we've done is we have we've created a declaration of power. Because at the end of the day, this sexualized violence, this sexualized culture is about power. Right? It's about making sure that women know at the end of the day that your most valuable contribution is a sexualized contribution. Right? And just reminding you that you're a little bit less than. And in the grand scheme of things, men are more powerful than women, with a little nudge here, a little wink there, and a pat on the ass in 2018. This is about power. If we want to see more women in power, we have to get women talking about and agreeing to end a culture of harassment and assault. And this declaration of power we have taken all over the country. We have these beautiful signs that talk about how this system wasn't really built for us. It definitely wasn't built by us. And so we need a moment to figure out what this system might look like if we were to begin to rewrite the rules. And we do need to rewrite the rules. So women from all over the country are signing it. One of the posters is actually in Representative Faith Winter's office. She's a Colorado State Representative here. And as many of you may know, she recently had her sexual harasser and assaulter expelled from the Colorado State Capitol. She also happens to be the National Training Director for Vote Run Lead and is the perfect person to help write our curriculum on how to do this. And after that day where she got him expelled, she went to Fort Collins and trained about 50 or 60 women to run for office. So there was no stopping her. we were like, I'm sorry, you can't have the day off. it was 111 days of this for her to go through this process. But because she was someone in a position of power, in a formal position of power, she was able to actually write the rules and set the agenda for how he was going to be held accountable. It had happened to his campaign manager, to interns, to other young women in the Capitol that didn't have that kind of power. And so even that process, they didn't have a process to make something like this, you know, to hold, to have consequences. And I think that's what young women are asking us for right now is consequences. What are the consequences of this going to be? I think women got out and marched, and you'll talk more about that, because it felt like there were no consequences for the statements that President Trump was making. It just felt like it got left out there, and nobody seemed to care about this particular issue. And we saw from the Me Too movement that it's more than pervasive. It's a commonplace thing for this to happen to women. And I'm so excited to see so many men in this room. That makes me so happy. Thank you. Because we can't do it by ourselves. Yes, we need 51% women in public office, and we're on our way. Help us, you know, nominate women, run yourselves. But we also need men in this fight with us. And if you look closely at Representative Winter's story, it was actually two men who stood by her in allyship, and I think quite honestly helped to swing some of the votes to get some of her colleagues to vote in support of expelling him. Because these things are connected, those two gentlemen were threatened by the representative who ended up being expelled for supporting her, because this is about a culture of power. Right? This is about him trying to make those men not stand up by her side, trying to keep her silent. And when we band together, we can get justice, we can get consequences. And I hope those solutions will be more of us running for office and winning, and more of us banding together, both men and women.
Hello, my name is Jessica Rogers. I was one of the organizers of the Women's March on Denver, both last year and this year. I got involved in the Women's March. I had not been an activist beforehand, and even though I consider myself a feminist, I had not been an active feminist beforehand, but really got involved once Trump was elected for many of the reasons that everybody was here probably very upset. So, thanks. Is that better? Yes. Oh, it sounds better. Thank you. So one of the things I want to talk about is it became a real passion of mine, a project we had initially started calling the Raise Your Hand Project. I don't know if any of you have seen the Netflix documentary Audra and Daisy, but it's about two young women who experienced sexual assaults in their high school. Neither were believed, and one was bullied to the point where she committed suicide. So I watched this documentary as we prepared for the first Women's March. And I think what really struck me in that is if those two girls could just have known how not alone they were, that it happens to most women, in fact, the majority of women. So I'm going to do this experiment here with you guys real quick and hope it goes well because I'm a little nervous about it. But this is what we did at the first march. The majority of the audience raised their hands, and then from that I was able to connect with Tarana Burke from Me Too for this second march. And launch this Raise Your Hand action as a international action, and I can speak more on that later. So, the United States government defines sexual assault as any forced or coerced action or behavior. This includes rape, attempted rape, molestation, and sexual harassment. If you or anyone you know has experienced sexual assault as defined by the United States government, please raise your hand. That is not okay. That is the majority of you. We specifically made this language non-sexual or non-gendered because, as Heather mentioned, in the military, there's a lot of assault on males. We also wanted to point out that it's not just men who perpetuate this, but women can as well. So we wanted to really point that out, and that the majority of people experience sexual assault as defined by the United States government. And when I first reached out to Tarana Burke, all of our pictures that we had from the first march were all of white women, because to be honest, the Women's March, that's our audience. It's middle-aged white women. So I addressed that specifically when I spoke to her, that the Me Too movement was started by a black woman to really highlight how minority and women of color communities experience sexual assault at a much higher rate than white women. So through that, we were able to incorporate and collaborate with a lot of communities in Denver that work with sexual assault, but we actually had a march on the East Coast that would not participate because they felt that the Me Too movement was so appropriated by white women. So when we talk about sexual assault and sexual harassment, we do have to acknowledge, too, that there is a line where one of my co-organizers did a radio show with a woman of color who works with a lot of women in the women of color communities who have experienced sexual assault. And her example is that although as women we may experience similar trauma, the resources that we have to deal with, that we have to help us after the fact, are different. So I had the option to not go to work, to get counseling, to have resources, to have help. And another woman in this woman's story, she had to go to work. She wasn't believed. She couldn't tell her boss. She had three kids she had to feed. So as we move forward, we need to understand that there are different resources and levels of impact for different groups.
Thank you, Jessica. And that's a great segue with where I want to get started. I do want to say I'm getting a lot of questions coming in, so thank you. And I hope we'll have plenty of time to take these questions coming in. But I did just want to start a little bit with the fact that, well, yes, we're talking. The Women's March was widely regarded as certainly initially was very much a white woman's movement. Pussy hats have been found by a great many people to be exclusive of people that are not cis white women. There's the four of us up here are all white women, and we're talking about women's future in politics and in leading and in dealing with sexual harassment. So, are these issues the issues for white women, about white women, of white women? Or how do we make sure that we're keeping women inclusive? How do we make sure we're including women of color? How do we make sure we're including trans women? How do we make this movement more inclusive, and how do we engage and form strong coalitions?
Well, I want to push back on that a little bit and say the Women's March, I think, did a fantastic job of leading with young women of color, with the co-founders as young women of color. I was at the Women's Conference in Detroit. I think they did a fantastic job of putting on stage and bringing in communities of color. And I quite honestly, I think the Women's March has shifted from maybe initially when the Facebook groups were getting together, but since January of 2017 has been women of color led and centered around the experiences of women of color, and they should be applauded for that. And I don't know, you know, if anybody was at the Detroit convention, but there was a conversation called Confronting White Womanhood, in which, you know, the they had to do it twice. The line was out the door, right, of people sort of trying, of white women trying to figure out what it is that we can do better. This panel should look better, right, should be more inclusive. But I think, honestly, this is one of the arenas that we have seen a handful of white women, including Alyssa Milano, who put out the Me Too, go back and say, no, the person who actually invented Me Too was Tarana Burke. Always, always, always there is ways to do better and be more inclusive. But I do want to acknowledge that we have set up some good patterns, and the young women of the Women's March have shown us a way in which to allow women of color to lead and to center the experiences of women of color. It's something very critical to the work we do at Vote Run Lead. It's something we should all, when we're talking about women, we should stop saying women and women of color. We should say women and men of color if we're talking about certain populations, because when we get to that place is when those descriptors are inclusive. But I do think that we need more research on women of color statistically. We need to look at the economic disparities that we're seeing that cross along lines of race, class, and gender. We need to be looking very closely and giving spotlight to trans women who experience violence at an astronomical rate compared to other populations. And I think those are some things where we need more media stories, we need more leadership, we need more inclusivity, and we need more resources around making sure that those, as you were saying, those folks are getting exactly the kind of access. We should be side by side in leading the fight against this.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to comment on what we should be doing right now to be more inclusive?
Well, what we've discovered with our Women's March is, so the second year we created a steering committee because we didn't have as much time as we had wanted to in our planning. So the steering committee was incredibly helpful as kind of just a Band-Aid for this last march. And what we've discovered that our plan is for this year is doing less action as far as like hosting stuff and then showing up to the actions that are already going on. So we felt that us being inclusive was... I don't know how to say, like, there was already activity going on before the Women's March for decades by many marginalized communities. So there was nothing new we could bring, and kind of trying to offer that was sometimes perceived as insulting. So we just found that showing up to the events that those organizations and communities have already been planning, again, because they've been doing the work for years, was the best way that we could include ourselves without dominating or leading or asking if help was needed. Because again, asking if help is needed implies that there's an absence that needs some kind of fixing. Whereas these communities have been working to their own ends for a very long time.
Thank you, Jessica. That leads me to think about something, Heather, you were saying earlier about your privilege, that you have privilege to be making lots of questions, and I think making lots of choices in your life. So how how do we use our privilege if we have privilege? How do we use it to lift up and support? To support the people who currently do not have privilege, who have important messages that they've been trying to get out. We see it with like Black Lives Matters, the treatment of Black Lives Matters versus the Parkland students, for instance. Mm-hmm. How do we work together without swooping in?
Well, I want to start actually by saying something optimistic about that, which is that if you look at state and local politics, there's a lot of controversy and a lot of angst at the national level, which takes up a lot of media space and a lot of emotional time. And I really salute both Jessica and Aaron, who have to live in that world every day, and who seem both to be very calm and breathing in a very regular way. But if you look at the reporting of E.J. Graff and Joan Walsh, who have both written quite a bit about women's activism at the local level, E.J. makes the point that at the local level, people really want to solve problems and change things and fight back. And so actually some of these debates around feminism and around sort of whose experience we center really actually are not as problematic at the local level as at the national level. And sometimes those of us who are active at the national level really need to take a lesson from our friends in local communities who are just walking into a room and saying, what's needed and how can we get it done? And a related example that has drawn a lot of discussion and controversy is the Alabama Senate race, where it is just undeniable, if you look at the numbers, that black women won that Senate seat. And there's been a lot of justified, I think, frustration around the tone of the national conversation, which either sort of didn't mention black women or acted like it had just discovered black women and they never existed before, you know, that Senate race. But the story about what happened on the ground, and now this isn't always true of the National Democratic Party, but that they came in with money and actually had the wit to say, who are the people who know these communities and how can we empower them to go out and lift up the vote? And we're not going to tell you how to turn out the black vote. We're going to ask you to do it. And that's a small example of getting something right, which I think we sometimes need in this area. But I think we all, and so then I'm going to go to the completely opposite extreme and say that we all personally have all kinds of opportunities to lift up other women's and other people's experiences. So if I can tell another anecdote, and I don't see this woman in the audience, but last night a young woman who's a student here came up to me, and she said, well, after I heard you speak on a panel on gender here last year, some of the folks from that panel were here earlier. She said, I went off and I proposed an independent study project on gender in international relations. And my professor said to me, oh, no, you can't do that because I'm uncomfortable with the idea that gender, that there's anything different about gender in international relations. So now, okay, I can tell that story to other people. I mean, first I was like, tell me who your professor is so I can go, A, give him a reading list, and B, punch him. what can I mean, I'm super lucky because I have a job where I actually get funded to write stuff about the incontrovertible social science about gender and international relations. So, you know, number one, I'm not allowed to get tired of doing that, and I'm not allowed to say, all right, yeah, damn it, I wrote that 2 years ago, and everyone hasn't figured it out yet. I'm bored. I want to write about something else. Nope. And I can say to myself, what else, you know, what other choices can I make to get this message out to more people? And what are the young women in my own organization not getting the chance to do that they want to do, and how can I lift that up when my colleague comes to me and says, Heather, you know that guy you suggested I interview? I'm really tired of him trying to fix me up with his son. Then, hey, guess what? I have to put on my, like, I'm the old lady here and figure out how to have that conversation. And then I have to figure out how to go to the boss and say, yeah, so you know that guy? Like, he might be really smart, but we got to counsel him or do something because we can't have him talking to the staff that way. So, and many of us are in this place in our lives where, you know, multiple times a week we have the ability to choose to lift up people's experience. And, man, it's really hard. I didn't train for this. Like, nobody warned me that this was going to be part of feminism. And, you know, plus at the same time, I'm getting older and I have a teenager in the house. I got to do this too? But I think that's what being an ally means.
Thank you. We've been talking about inclusivity along color and identity lines, but I'm definitely getting some questions about inclusivity along the political spectrum. So the women's movement, the women's march, organizations like Vote Run Lead are, I think, pretty strongly associated with progressive women, with democratic women. Where do conservative women fit in this movement? Why have or have pro-life women been ousted by the women's movement? And maybe Erin, this is something you would like to address. How does your organization decide which women to back? Is there a preference towards progressive women, women from the left? How do political ideologies fit into this?
Conservative women are sexually harassed and assaulted as much as progressive women. While I welcome these questions, I'm very transparent with my face, and you might all see me, like, up here. And I want to have an inclusive conversation, but I want to say that the President of the United States has been accused of sexual harassment and assault by over 24 women. And young women put this panel together because they want to, I think, have a real conversation about what that means for all of us, for conservative women, for progressive women, for trans women, for white women, for women of color. And I don't want to get tripped up in how we make this like the best possible movement right now. I think we're in a moment where we are in the reckoning part, and it is time for accountability and naming and shaming. And we are not finished naming and shaming. Women in the medical field, women in, like, they're not publishing. They're like, how come we haven't had our own internal Me Too movement happen within this sector? We are still in the naming and shaming moment, and I want you to continue to name and shame. And I want to have these inclusive conversations, but I want to be like, this is happening like right now, you know, on campus to somebody, like statistically happening right now. So I think that's where we are. We have finally named a problem that we have not named for decades. We are still in the naming and shaming phase. The next phase is to say collectively, what do we think the policies should be that are formalized, that are written, that can help shape the culture? And what is the cultural movement that we want to have pushing consistently so that this never happens again and that those policies just don't become, you know, something that was written into law by a couple of progressive state legislators or a couple of forward-thinking companies and it actually doesn't become sort of dominant culture in the country. And so I want to name that before we sort of dig into this, like, how do we include conservative women? How do we include, you know... Because this is happening to all of us. Like, sexual harassment and assault doesn't give a shit what, you know, who you voted for in the last election at all. And we owe it to our daughters for us to be saying really to one another that I don't care that you voted differently than I voted. I don't care that you have a totally different lived experience that I have. This cannot happen to you. This cannot happen to me. And how are we going to work together to make it happen? And, you know, I told the story yesterday. I was in the bathroom of NPR. Where you saw one of, you know, several of their top executives, you know, were let go. It was a really pervasive culture where in the sort of liberal bastion, NPR, right? And there's all these post-it notes in the women's room that are like, you're awesome, you're amazing. And it's become part of this culture of making women feel stronger so that they can go out and actually share their stories. These are journalists who are professionally paid to share stories, right? Share their own stories within this liberal institution. And then we have something happens at CPAC with, again, I'm forgetting her last
Mona
name.
Mona Charon.
Yes, Mona Charon, who at CPAC on a conversation says to the conservative audience, we have a problem with sexual assault and harassment if we're not going to have a conversation about President Trump and what is happening in the world right now. And she got escorted out by security. Yet... silently, she had an echo chamber on Twitter and email and Facebook messages of women on the right and the left say to her, thank you, right? I'm deeply concerned with this as part of my political identification, that I have to just act like this wasn't a big deal, otherwise I'm not a good party member. So women on the left have to reach out to women on the right to say, this is not about an ideological, et cetera. I don't care if we voted differently in the 2016 election. We're going to have to work together if we're going to solve this pervasive problem. And at Vote Run Lead, our resources are open to all women. We have an intersectional feminist belief. We believe in the best values of feminism as part of our organization. And that includes diversity, of course, along racial and ethnic lines, geography, but it also includes diversity of perspective. And so I'm constantly keeping lines of communication open to more conservative women. But I'm also finding moderate Republican women have nowhere to go right now. And they are asking for some sisterhood and saying, it's okay that we don't agree on X issue or that we voted differently. On this, we can work together. And that's what I would like to see across a variety of lines, because this is one of those issues that just does not have any, it has nothing to do with your likelihood of being affected by it if you are a Republican or a Democrat.
Thanks. And I wonder if that's part of the answer to a question I've gotten a couple versions of as well. So, which is essentially, so white women voted for Trump by 52, 53%, something like that. So why are white women, along with all women, why are white women on the streets now? How does one reconcile white women voting for Trump with white women and many, many, many women of many, many different stripes protesting against Trump and working for a better representation in government now?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. How is it reconciled? I don't know, because I mean, I was a woman who obviously did not vote for Trump, and all of my female friends did not either. So it's hard for me to even know or imagine that 53%. And I guess it's just reconciled in the best way that I know, which is that a bunch of white middle-aged women turned out for the Women's March, and then we keep trying and we keep showing up, and I think that that's all that we can really do at this. Well, that's not all we can do, but, you know, run and vote and campaign and just keep showing up and keep pushing it forward, and just make sure that you're getting every younger person you know to vote, get everybody to vote, because those 53% turned out because they were told to, because they did, they showed up. And I think if all of us had shown up, if everyone had shown up, it would have been a lot more balanced.
So we know that until or through the 2016 election, gender was not a particularly good predictor of your vote, that your ideology and your race were much better predictors. So 53% of white women voted for Trump because they believe that conservative values are better for them and for our society. And, you know, if you don't like that, you've got some work to do. And there's the sort of, that's another version of the white woman problem, which we can talk about on other panels. The challenge for this issue, which both Aaron and Jessica have talked about in different ways, is that, you know, we do have, although it feels like we all live in bubbles, we do have a culture that's permeable in a lot of ways. And as we've seen, the perpetrators who've been unmasked in the last, you know, 8 or 10 months of Me Too have been all across the field ideologically, all across the field profession-wise. And so this, in a funny way, our conversation has been running Me Too and the Women's March together, but they're actually quite different phenomena. I mean, and Jessica, mm-hmm. you talked about their different origins. But, and we have to be content with the idea that our activism, our goal on Me Too, is making life better for all women and all people who might be subjects of sexual harassment and assault, even if they don't agree with us politically. I mean, as you said. So we do have, you know, there is this reality, and I'm going to steal Aaron's awesome line from yesterday, that it turns out we don't vote with our vaginas. But that doesn't mean And it's going to be very interesting to watch over the next year as you do start to see, what's the name of that dude? Blake Farenthold. I mean, we lost, quote unquote, we won getting rid of another Republican congressman in the past week, right? So, I mean, there's so much crazy stuff going on that you might have barely even noticed that. But Me Too is having a cross-partisan effect.
Right.
So, which can, I think, even as we have the gaping partisan divide we have, we can still get some places on Me Too.
We have to have conversations with each other. I say that as the all-white woman panel. We have to have conversations with, we all know a woman who voted for Hillary, we all know a woman who voted for Trump. We need to have a conversation to ask why, to be really curious and to listen. Because there are smart, talented women who made a choice in the 2016 election. They knew what they were choosing. They knew the number of women that had come forward around assault and harassment, and they made a choice. So the question is, how do you make that balance? I want to better understand what that balance means for you. What do you put above as a priority as women's health and safety? I want to know what those choices that you're making, because I'm really curious about it. And I think the other thing of looking at why it was sort of so easy for us to vilify Hillary Clinton and to make that choice kind of easy for some folks is also about this sort of culture of how we treat women and women who are powerful. Secondly, all women are not the same. We're not like a bunch of five-year-olds on the soccer field who all chase the ball in the same direction, right? We are 51, maybe 52% of the population. As we get older, we're even more. We are all not going to move in the same way. We have to understand the diversity within the population of women. We also need to ask these women for solutions. What would be a way that you would want to see this remedied? Because they don't disagree that this is a problem. So how do we bring them into the conversation to say, what might your solution be? How do you make something like this change so that your daughter and my daughter doesn't have to deal with this when they go into the workforce? So there's a level of engagement there. There's a level of listening that needs to happen. There's, you know, because you're not, these, they're not all of a sudden going to start voting a different way next week, right? They have figured out what their priorities are, and they're voting on those priorities. I want to know how you came up with that ranking of those priorities that put harassment and assault so low on the list.
I actually want to jump in and say something else that's a little bit challenging for those of us who identify on the left. Two things, actually. As you know from my bio, I worked in the Clinton White House. And when I think about how I thought about these issues in the 90s, I'm not very proud of myself. And I wonder if some of you in the audience might think back to how you thought about these issues in the 90s and feel the same way. And maybe you feel a little uncomfortable when Aaron says, well, they knew these things and they voted for him anyway. So I think when we shake our heads about Trump voters, those of us who were old enough to vote at that time, and it's a complex issue, and I don't feel like I have any great moral certainty about it, and I'm still very proud of the work I did in the 90s, but I think we have to acknowledge that it's not like nothing like this ever happened before.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I think we have to look at and say, oh, wow, this is a very real obstacle we're still facing, is the shaming and the attacks that Senator Gillibrand faced for sort of suggesting that, you know, maybe President Clinton had done some of the things that the women accused him of doing, and of saying that Al Franken should step down. I had this conversation with my mother-in-law at Thanksgiving. And my mother-in-law is such a wonderful feminist who's been, you know, worked for political reform and was an organizer. And she said, you know, and she's asked me, I mean, the question that your relatives always ask you when you work in politics, you know, who do you like? And I said, well, you know, I'm really impressed with Gillibrand. And my mother-in-law said, oh, well, I'm not going to forgive her for what she did to Al Franken. And I looked at my mother-in-law, and I was like, okay, I have to be nice. It's the holidays. And I said, so, Phyllis, you know I go to the Hill a lot, and you know I go on office visits. Like, you'd be okay if he did that to me? You're really okay with your daughter-in-law going to meet with the senator and him, you know, grabbing her? Because that's what we're talking about. And it was really interesting. My mother-in-law was like, oh, I never thought about it that way.
So I have a student question here following up on this. And just
so do I.
like to, you know, just digging in even more to the Me Too movement. So what, this was a great example. What do we say to women that are not passionate about the Me Too movement? And how do we get everyone involved? What are really concrete things like like Heather just shared with us?
Oh, my God. I still have not had the conversation with my mother about Garrison Keillor.
You know, I want to take the energy of the women who are passionate about the Me Too movement. I want to see, you know, I want to see like an online manifesto where we get to, you know, put policy forward and say, like, what would you do here on campus? If you want to see a really strong sexual harassment and assault policy, what would it look like? Who would write it? You know, we have the tools with technology to do that kind of crowdsourcing of information. I want to see focus groups. I want to see the resources behind what kind of policies we might actually put in place. I want to see some experimentation with those policies. I want to see young men in these focus groups. I want to see young men talk to older men. I find generationally this has been really tough where older men have said things to me like, oh, what, you can't even shake a hand anymore, right? And younger men have said like, oh my God, I had no idea. So both are problems, right? So what's the perception that we have generationally? How do we have those conversations within men? How do we create spaces for those men to get together and say, I think maybe I probably have done something not so great in my past, but I have like two feminist amazing daughters and I voted for Hillary, right? Like this is okay. We need to have these kind of conversations, put this stuff in the sunlight. I think those women who are not necessarily passionate about Me Too, unfortunately, there will likely be someone, everybody knows someone who it's happened to, and when that happens, you will see that passion change. Because when you go, when you actually look at what the pathways for justice are, and you see that sometimes there are no pathways for justice, they have not been set up, that's when you actually get folks who would then be galvanized. But I want to be a little bit hopeful and say that previously women used to come forward, if they came forward, right? Previously women never came forward. This was a silent thing. Now women have come forward, women were coming forward, and they were being told, you know, anything even around sexual assault. I just watched the Paterno documentary, right? They were told, he's a good guy. Don't ruin his career, right? Mm-hmm. So if they were taken any further, and they would have negative repercussions on their career. Many women opted out. Right now, at this moment of time, women are being heard. It's not enough, but it's going in the right direction. We're being heard, we're being believed. I think you're going to see a very different outcome at the Bill Cosby trial because the culture has changed, and I'm looking forward to that. And what you're also seeing is, in politics particularly that we're seeing, is young women in these state legislatures saying, this is unacceptable, and we're actually going to write some legislation on this. We're going to write some legislation, and we're going to put it into practice. What else we're seeing that's a sort of happy anecdote politically is that lots of these guys are retiring. Now, I don't know if they're retiring because they have a Me Too incident in their past, but, you know, I could care less, but they're retiring. They're taking a look at the landscape and they're saying, wow, there's an entire generation of young people, of women, of a diverse group of people stepping forward, and maybe it's time for me to, you know, step aside. And so you're having open seats, which means it's very likely that you'll have new and fresh perspectives and a new opportunity to pass some of this legislation. So I suggest that we all think about, we all can be policy experts because actually no one has the answer on this just yet. So thinking about what we would do if we ran a workplace, what we would do if we were to potentially write legislation, put that out on social media, put that on a Facebook, you know, get together with somebody who knows how to craft some policy and figure out what it might be because we're not yet at the place where we have seen really successful pathways to justice and we need to write it ourselves.
And I will say, I mean, so the question was how you get someone to be passionate about Me Too. Was that? So I think having everyone be passionate about it isn't as necessary as having everybody understand and believe
right.
that the Me Too movement exists because these women are telling the truth. It does happen on this scale. It has happened on this scale. And it will sadly continue to happen on this scale until more women come out and speak about the Me Too. And I think another thing that's incredibly interesting is I've had so many discussions with friends about this, but that so much of what people have been called out for, a lot of it has been very overt assault. And a lot of it has been harassment that, I mean, if you look at, I've been watching Cheers lately. That is just full of sexual harassment. And even some of the shows from the 90s, Friends and Gilmore Girls, like it was part of my pop culture growing up. Like the normalization of women saying, oh, we just accept the compliments we can get. Or it's okay that my boyfriend is like bad and eats Cheetos and I'm the breadwinner, because that was part of the comedy trope. That was part of the pop culture trope of what we were buying into. So I think a lot of it does take time to change. But our pop culture with our younger people is really making that change. I mean, we have Wonder Woman. We have Jessica Jones. We have the girl from Star Wars. We have tons of women running for office now. So it's this empowering that's going on at a cultural level. And it's also really good at making sure people understand and believe that it does happen at the massive scale that you saw when you all raised your hands.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up the idea of culture. I have a question from Kyrgyzstan. Specifically about culture, and I think we certainly are aware that there are very many traditional cultures that have very strong gender roles, so how do we so for instance, this question says that in my country the culture plays a great role. Women should do all the housework and always depend on the men. So this, and this is certainly these. People belong to all sorts of different cultures. Are people who believe in these cultures excluded from this movement, or how do we bring these in? I mean, I think it's clear that, even with traditional roles like this, that doesn't mean that one should be subject to sexual harassment, but...
Yeah, I think we're going to learn a lot more about this. We don't have the research on it because it's one of many, many ways that women are regarded as small men, and it's not that important to do research on us. But there is this fabulous social science, seriously, medical research, look it up. There is this really interesting social science research which holds up across cultures that the single best predictor of whether your society is going to engage in civil conflict or external conflict is the rate of violence against women. Mm-hmm. And the woman who led that work, Valerie Hudson, who's a professor at Texas A&M, has developed a really interesting, elaborate theory about sort of culture and how a culture safeguards women. Because cultures, there is really no culture which is like, yeah, hey, cool, everybody can just go rape any woman they can find. All cultures, sort of, there's some way that women are regarded as a store of value, if not having inherent full equal value in ourselves. So, in fact, the idea that you don't want the women in your community raped or assaulted or demeaned or degraded is a commonality across cultures. Now, whether you also think that women should be able to run for president, that's, as the questioner says, dramatically different across cultures. But a point that I always make, and it's frustrating, I feel I don't make it with a great deal of success, is that the idea that violence against women, that allowing violence against women with impunity is really bad for everybody in a set. We've also, by the way, incredible statistics about what it does to children, both male and female, to be exposed to their mothers being abused and assaulted. I mean, again, that's just one of the worst things you can do for the future of a society. So in point of fact, the core issue here is universal.
Well, and following up on that, from which cultures or nations might we learn useful lessons about how we treat women? Is anyone doing it well?
Even the cultures that one immediately thinks of as, oh, I want to go live there. So Scandinavia would be the thing that first comes to mind. But the interesting thing that happens is when you get a sector and you sort of introduce a lot more women to that sector, or you mandate women's participation in that sector becomes a less prestigious sector. So unfortunately, it looks like the urge to discriminate is also a universal urge. So I would never say don't learn anything from Scandinavia, but it's also sort of not the case that you can import the Scandinavian model here and make things work perfectly. I'll also point out that there are some real cultures that use quotas. There are some real problems with that, but there's also no culture that has used quotas and like collapsed into the ground and ceased to exist as a culture.
Okay, let's shift topics a little bit. I've gotten a few questions about language, and specifically, there's a few flavors here. But if we are concerned about sexualized language, and that the role that the way that we use sexualized language about violence in particular, how does that play against the a panel whose name is Pussy Grabs Back, which one person has noted made it actually difficult for them to attend this panel? So how do we resolve that?
I think we don't resolve it, frankly.
Let's have some tension.
I'm the oldest of the speakers, and there's a lot of language that makes me uncomfortable, and, you know, would I want my son running around? No, I wouldn't. But I also want to respect for some people, taking hold of this language mm-hmm. is empowering. Mm-hmm. And so, right. to me, this is, we need, and we haven't always done this very well in feminism, but we need to have, and frankly, thanks to the fabulous job done by the conference, there are a lot of panels on women and women's issues in the moment at this conference. So what I'm really happy about is if there's anyone who didn't come to this panel because of the title, they did have other panels to go to right. to discuss these issues. And I think I want to be sensitive and not use words that offend an audience, but I also want people for whom those whatever words have great power to be able to use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I think the tension is good because the tension is not coming because the young women chose this out of the air, right? The tension is coming because that was something that we heard recorded by a man who is now elected to the United States presidency. And that is a big deal. That is a big deal generationally that will last with these young women for the next 60 or 70 or 80 years, however long they live. And that's, you know, in thinking about words that have been controversial and appropriating them and having those communities reappropriate those to have meaning for them has been powerful consistently across the board. So the question is, why does that make us uncomfortable? And the reason is because the conversation we're having right now is about having women under attack around harassment and assault. Mm-hmm. And that's, I'm glad, right? Uncomfortable conversations lead us to a place where we get comfortable about things that have happened that we need to have sort of some sunlight on. So again, I want to applaud the students. I mean, we've been laughing about it for sort of weeks, knowing that this was going to be the panel and this was the, because of course it should be controversial. We should feel a little bit of tension about this, and we should be asking, why did they want to name the panel this? Right? And that is about a larger problem that we need to solve together.
Well, and I find it so, I mean, it just struck me with the question of it, referring to pussy as a word of violence, I think. Somehow I got that connection, but.
I did sort of make that allusion. Okay. Really, just the sexual terminology, I think, is the underlying. But sexual language being applied to violence and sexual language being applied to this conference.
Right. Well, and I think, so in the last year and a half in my world, being involved in the Women's March and all the activism, like pussy, like you've seen all the signs that say this pussy grabs back and pussy hats, like for the last year, this word has taken like a whole other meaning in my mind, in which like I didn't even blink at the topic of this because it just seemed like status quo, like, yes, these are all really strong, intelligent women talking about an issue that really matters. So why is pussy a bad word? And it's not. And we need to reclaim it.
All right, I'm throwing a little time check here. We've got about 8 minutes left in our panel. I keep checking for questions on here, so feel free to keep sending them in. Although we're not going to have time for too much more. One of the ideas, and this is a question that's come in a few times as well, one of the ideas that kind of underlies this whole panel, this topic, is, well, really, what's so important about having women in leadership roles?
Ooh,
anyway?
Yes,
mean, should we be, I mean, does, how do, shouldn't we be more concerned just about abilities?
No. No, 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 no. All the research says that we are doing the business of government better, that we are bringing a different experience to leadership, that diversity of leaders, diversity of groups produces better outcomes, right? And we can throw more money at the research and the outcomes are going to be the same. When you have a group of people who have had like the same sort of return on like rewards for certain behaviors or a style or have mimicked a style or have been taught one particular style of leadership, and then you throw a whole different body of folks who have often been at the foot of the table, now at the head of the table, they are going to use the skills of organizing and leadership that they developed at the foot of the table mm-hmm. at the top of the table, mm-hmm. which is a more flat line, more open and transparent. We see it in government. Women are more likely to talk with their constituents, to find diverse opinions in making decisions. We're long-term solution-oriented. We have less ego drive in our desire to get things done. We run for office because we want to see a solution, not necessarily because we want to be called United States Senator, though that would be nice too. We're ambitious in the sense of, there's sort of two definitions of ambition. You know, the Merriam-Webster, if you open it up, the first A says for rank, power, or fame. And I ask at my trainings, is this why you're here? Is this why you're running? And, you know, some of the women, and actually some of the more younger women are like, yeah, I'll take that, right? I'll take a little power. Definition B is a desire to achieve impact. And the whole audience raises their hand. And those are the motivations that we see from women into power structures that haven't necessarily been built for or by us. So we are definitely seeing maybe it's the way we're raised, maybe we're wired differently, nobody actually knows the answer exactly, but they know that when you put more women in leadership, boards get more money, companies do better. When you see the health and well-being of girls who are educated, that countries thrive and flourish, that boys do better. Their sort of country's GDP goes up. I mean, I could write a book, but there are hundreds of other books on this topic as well, that diverse leadership is good leadership. And that when women bring their sort of, whether it's 33% or maybe 25%, you see men behaving differently too, and a swapping of leadership styles in which, you know, sometimes it's time for a decisive action on behalf of the female CEO, and sometimes it's time for collaborative action on behalf of the male CEO. And we have a blending of leadership styles. We mix it up between the hierarchical model and the flat model. So it's not that one gender has the best toolkit for leadership. It's that when we're together and we're bringing the diversity of our skills to the table, we all actually do better in how we are achieving those outcomes. And we are desperately in need of women in public office and in leadership, because the experiences of women are not actually on the agenda just yet. So it was Connie Morales and Pat Schroeder here in Colorado who put paid family leave together as a Republican and a Democrat around maternity leave. And it was just not on the agenda of men, right? And it's like, okay, we probably can't blame them because they can't have babies. So they don't actually have that particular experience. And now we're seeing, you know, women in the military come forward. It's the female congresswomen and the female senators who are putting that legislation forth. We're seeing when it comes to girls' education, it's women carrying the water of the experiences that girls and women are having, which may not just be in the line of sight for men right now or in the past. And so that's a critical component, that we're actually changing what is going on the agenda. And we're taking issues like the economy, and we're saying, what is the effect via gender? So if women are making 70 cents to the dollar or 54 cents to the dollar if you're Latina, we can come at that from both a conservative and progressive rationale that women need to be making equal to men. You can come at it from the perspective that it's a fair and just thing to do, that equal pay for equal work is right. And you can come at it from an economic standpoint, that 30 cents in her pocket or 50, 46 cents in her pocket is actually good for the economy and good for the community that she lives in, because she's going to spend it, right? She's going to put it back into the local economy. So it's like there are so many reasons for us to be investing in women right now, that it's like it's the smart thing to do. Yeah. Well,
and I, putting together the biographies of the women we had on our steering committee, right now women of color are one of the highest educated demographics in the country. They also have, and women in general, have tons of experience with community organizing backgrounds. So who I want as a leader is somebody who is highly educated and then has tons of community organizing experience. And those candidates are out there. And those are the women of color. And those are the people that have been organizing in their communities. And all women. Most women. But women.
Okay, let's see. Oh, I need to step in with one correction here. The clock on my computer is fast, so we actually still have 6.5 minutes. I've gotten a bunch of questions in the last few minutes about going back to the topic of sexual assault and harassment and how to deal with it. So there's a bunch of questions here. How do students deal if they've been assaulted by a student or a teacher at any age level? How do we ensure fairness in any kind of justice proceedings? What does fairness even look like in those proceedings? It's a rotten, rough, horrible experience when you read people's stories. I guess so. With those two,
one thing I'll say, and I was an RA in college, a resident assistant, and so you deal a lot with just various stories of your peers, and really high levels of confusion of young men around what is consent. And I think that is I'm so excited around the conversation that we're having around consent right now. And really, yes is yes, and no is no, right? And I can now no longer listen to that Christmas song, Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Yeah.
It's like, I just can't do it.
Yeah.
So we've come a long way in that sense. So I think educating young men about consent, particularly on college campuses, is extremely valuable. We should be doing it on a constant year-round basis. One of the things that I'm uncomfortable with is that these crimes live within the campus authority, and these are crimes, and they need to go to the police, right? And, like, they need to be given to the police. The idea that we're counting sexual assault on campuses as a number that colleges get to hide is disgusting. These are crimes, and they need to go through the criminal justice system. It's one of the ways which we've sort of taken the power. And so for me, those are two, I think, concrete things that we can do, particularly on college campuses. But I do think for young women, there are some, if this does happen to you, you know, whether it's particularly around harassment, the contemporaneous evidence is really important, right? Sharing it with someone via email and in a way that your story is set straight in a short amount of time afterwards. I know that is tough, but it's one of the things we talk about. It's, you know, especially around harassment, if you've been harassed at the workplace, send that email to somebody else that you trust, even if you're not just ready to, like, take it to the higher ups, so that when it does happen, there's the sort of like the Comey rule, right? The contemporaneous notes really matter. And in that way, you have the choice later on if you want to go ahead with the harassment complaint in a workplace. But I do think there's things in college campuses that we can be doing quite differently. Those are small, very practical.
The only thing, I have one thing I would add to that, which is find somebody who will believe you, find somebody who's older or more senior, who you trust, who can help you think through how to deal with the process. I, as I mentioned, this is something else I wanted to say. I always say, oh, I was really lucky. I just had one instance where someone grabbed my ass. Now, that's totally unacceptable. But it's also, in the scheme of things that happen to women, pretty mild. And I was extraordinarily fortunate that when that happened to me, I was also doing some freelance work for General Claudia Kennedy. And Claudia Kennedy was the first woman to make 3-star general. And she had an experience in her career. I believe she was already a 1-star general. She was chased around her desk by another 1-star general. And she did what many of us did for many years and just, like, managed to throw him out of her office and sucked it up and went on with her career until that man was nominated to be chief of personnel for the Army. And she said to herself, I cannot in good conscience allow that man to have the final say over discipline of hundreds of thousands of young men and women. And she came forward and told her story knowing that it would mean the end of her career. And it did mean the end of her career. She knew she had no chance at a promotion because she told her story. The guy was not made chief of personnel of the Army. She retired, and she wrote a book and went on the lecture circuit, and I happened, through great good fortune, to be invited to help her polish her lecture a little bit at the moment that this thing happened to me. And after several days of being like, I can't tell anyone, I was like, I bet she could tell General Kennedy. But it took an enormous amount of like, I was like, I'm complaining, I don't know her well enough, she's paying me on a project, it's like she's going to think it's none of her business, I'm wasting her time because she's this important 3-star general. And she was great. She said, oh, like, I believe you, and that's a big deal, and we're going to talk about the structure of your organization and who it's safe for you to go to. And it did, and I was able to, well, I don't know, I have mixed feelings about the outcomes of that, but, nothing ever happened to the guy, but nothing ever happened to me again, so 50-50, would I do it better now? Maybe I would, but find somebody that you believe and it's going to be your champion, because for all the reasons Aaron said, you need one.
Thank you, Heather. I think that's terrific advice for all of us, for everything. We have about one more minute to wrap up. So, Aaron and Jessica, I wonder if you have one piece of advice you might want to leave our audience with.
Well, and just in regards to the last question, too, I think finding somebody that will be your champion, and not to like push this idea forward again of raise your hand, but the whole idea behind that was if those two women, Audra and Daisy, from that Netflix documentary, One Who Had Killed Herself, had any idea of how many women share the exact same experience, then I think that their lives would have been totally different. So I think what I want to encourage is having women talk about their experience, and not to normalize it for it to be okay, but to normalize the discussion of it. Because I think it's so important that we acknowledge that it has been a cultural phenomenon that is coming to an end. But the only way it can come to an end is if we all speak about how it's impacted each of us.
Yeah, I'm an optimist. I was drinking a glass of water at my host's house, and it said, you know, half full, half empty. And every time I sipped out of it, I had to refill it. So, you know, this conversation makes me really hopeful. As frustrating as this is, I'm having conversations with my male peers that I've never had before. We're having conversations in the workplace. We're building how to talk about sexual assault and harassment into our curriculum. We've never done that before. We're putting the sunlight on this issue, and I'm hearing stories from women. The generational storytelling is phenomenal, the shared experience. And I'm hopeful that as we begin to shed some of these burdens off of women, that as we begin to shed some of this, some of these impediments that assault and harassment bring, that we're only going to do more fantastic things, that we're only going to see more women in these industries, we're only going to see more amazing films and television and authors and politicians and, you know, women business owners. We're only going to thrive more and more because we've been thriving with this stuff coming at us. And so I'm really hopeful for the resilience that women have shown, for the sort of quote-unquote pussy power that the students have shown. That all of that makes me really hopeful that we're beginning to shed some of these layers and that there's more to come, more fantastic stuff to come.
Great. Thank you all. And thank you all for coming to Pussy Grabs Back, the Women on the March.